nobody walks past the website. In the early days, people were hungry for stuff, and so like you essentially got effects similar to foot traffic, but there's no foot traffic on the internet. You can't replicate that formula.
That's Abe Burmeister, co-founder of Outlier, a menswear brand driven by fabric innovation. We talked with Abe about the brand story back on episode 7, but today, Abe and I spoke specifically about Outlier's marketing journey as a bootstrapped and product-driven company that is focused on content and communication from day one. I'm Richie Siegel, the founder of Loose Threads, which analyzes and advises next-generation consumer companies, and Facelift by Loose Threads, a retail incubator and accelerator for leading brands and retailers. For our latest analysis and insights, check out our free weekly newsletter at loosethreads.com. I started the Megaphone podcast to talk with the marketers, analysts, and advertising professionals navigating the roller coaster ride of building a consumer brand in the 21st century. That's why I was excited to talk with Abe about Outlier's marketing evolution over the last 11 years, which includes how it found a home on Reddit, Instagram Live, and Depop, and how it has reacted to the dramatically changing marketing landscape. Here's how they did it.
If you know the skate world, there's like Danny Way, right? He was a huge skater. And his brother was this guy named Damon Way. And Damon was at DC Shoes for a long time. And then he had moved over to Incase. And he was running marketing at Incase, I think. But a really good friend of mine, Roy Dank, was like, went and had a meeting with him. And they happened to be building a line of bags at that time, working with the main fabric provider, the Schoeller Textiles in Switzerland, which is like one of our biggest partners and our original partner, and they make some of the most advanced textiles in the world, right? So Roy was in this conversation with Damon, and he was just like, yeah, my friend, I think that's the company my friend is using to make these pants. And we were basically in pre-launch, but we had a blog going, and we had this sort of hypothesis that we could make a website that was a blog so that was always fresh, right? This is when people still went to websites.
What were you writing on there?
It was just like little things, like pictures of us biking around, little process updates and stuff. But the audience was like, I don't know, 5 or something, right? So it was like us warming up and like getting ready to get product. But Roy was like, yo, Damon, like, check out my friend's site. And he was like, this is cool. And then he put it on his blog, which was attached to a network called ArcTip, I think. It was like a small network, but like he was connected. People from the skate world and the marketing world were like, yo, let's check this out. And it was one sentence with a typo in it, but it linked to us. And we didn't even have a mailing list at that time. Like when we learned that we got linked to, I was like scrambling to code myself. I like hand coded a mailing list sign up form to stick on our website. Cause I was like, what are we going to do with this traffic? Yeah. Like we weren't ready for it.
Is this like before MailChimp?
Yes. This is before they were a well-known product. Sure. That's for sure. Yeah. I scrambled to put this together. And since Damon's blog wasn't that popular, but he had like the right audience. Right. So it ended up on like High Snobbity and PSFK. I think those are the main ones that had like kind of really thrived since then, but they were both like pretty decent sized sites at that time, with this little link to some of the photos we had posted that were basically like me, like with my like little digital camera, or Tyler with my partner with his digital camera. So it was a lot of scrappiness like that, right? We were like shooting at the golden hour, which is like super simple photographer's trick. And if you have more time than money, it's a great trick, but you have to rely on like the light being right, the weather being right, like all these
40
factors.
40 minutes or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This tight little window, but we're shooting photos ourselves. It was all really scrappy. It was PayPal button to buy the stuff. But yeah, so what happened is we had this little like small, not even viral, like micro viral hit. But you know, we hit the blog world and we built a mailing list off that. We just started collecting names, and that was kind of like the launch. The next phase beyond that, I mean, so I had this hypothesis. I had designed a website for a furniture store. I'd built some prototypes of like the blog as a store. So it's something I had thought about. That was like a couple years before, and they ended up not going with it. You know, it's like early in social media. And so people used to just go to blogs and be like, what's new on this website, or follow RSS feeds, right? So there still was this whole blog network that was different than like a magazine, essentially, which is what they are now, right?
Yeah.
We realized that they needed content, and that if we just went and shot digital photos and put them up and like release product, there was a good chance they would cover it. So we didn't really think about marketing very much at all for too long, really. But we did think about some of the infrastructure of the internet and like what was going on. And so we realized that, like, you know, we would make product and product that's innovative and new. And so the product would lead, and then we'd be like, all right, let's go and photograph this as best we can, as scrappily as we can, but like make juicy images and have a little bit of a story to go with it. and just put it out there. And, you know, we would like hit up blogs that have like little forms where you could like submit content, or, you know, then you start getting emails and doing like essentially like scrappy PR level stuff. But we really built off that. Very early stuff was very cycling specific. The first year and a half, we were like focused on cycling. And
like urban cycling.
Yeah, like bike commuting, bike to work, very niche, but like very intentional. We realized that these products had like a lot more possibilities than just the cycling, but like it's good to give yourself design parameters, right? Mm-hmm. If you're like trying like design for everything, then you design for nothing, right? So we were very focused on that, and we got frustrated with it pretty early on, but it treated us really well for the first year. Cycling was blowing up, right? It was the era of like fixed gear and like bike commuting. And so the first year we were like kind of rode that wave. You know, we figured out a few little pieces of the internet. We were extremely early in direct to consumer. We weren't the first. I found out about Bonobos because they were in the same factory as us, like making pants in New York City. They were still making pants in New York City at this like extremely starter factory. The owner of the factory was like, you need to make pants like these. Like, they're making so many pants. They're selling so many. And we were like, it's not our aesthetic. It's not our thing. But I was like, what is this? And then it was interesting. You know, the model that we had used at that time was a company called Finisterre. They're a cold water surfing company out of Cornwall in England. You know, they had kind of like one of the first to like really figure out the like, let's put this stuff online and go direct to the consumer and see like, you know, how it affects the margins, which is less and less true. But at the time, it was real, right? Basically, when you could get free marketing, like you could price things much better on the internet than you can now.
It sounds like the energy was very much going into the product, and the marketing was a byproduct of that in a sense. At what point did you start to feel that was working less? Or for the first X amount of years, it worked? And just
it worked. We essentially invested in product and photography for the first 8 years or so. You know, photography is definitely marketing, and we would go out and do things and like push further than other brands, especially for our size. So like there's a lot of realness there. And, you know, we meet people like, especially really early on, it was crazy. Like people would come and like pitch us and stuff. We'd be like, why is this PR firm like pitching us? And they'd be like, we thought you were like a real company. And we're like, you know, the first 2 year, year and a half, like me and Tyler were working full-time jobs, right? So it was a side project. So that was the first 8 years, product and photography. And we rode that for too long. So somewhere around like year six or seven, like we saw the warning signs, and in retrospect, it's very obvious, but our web traffic started leveling out, and we were investing a lot in merchandising and product development. And so we were selling more and more stuff to the same consumers. And so our sales numbers were still really good. Like it was an incredible sales yield actually, but we ignored this very clear warning sign in retrospect, which was that, wow, like our web traffic is getting flat. So like, where are the new people coming from, right? Like there's constant churn in business. So you need to be out there even to stay the same size, right? Like if you want to stay flat, you still need to invest in marketing, right? Because people move on or they have too much. I mean, we make very durable stuff. So people like our set. They're like, yeah, I got like enough stuff. So we ignored that warning sign. We were like, yeah, we see that, but numbers are still going up, which is great. And so it's kind of like Wile E. Coyote out up in the air, like off the cliff, and like you're still like up, right? But like you're off the cliff. So we woke up about a year later and we're like, wait, what's going on? Like we're not seeing the same sales growth anymore. And so we had to like dig really deep and like think and be like, all right, like let's look structurally, what are we doing wrong? And like it was really like ignoring the press, ignoring the marketing side, that we realized what was up. And so that's when we're like, okay, let's figure out this marketing stuff.
How do you think you got there? Or I guess like what were some of the implicit decisions that were made in those prior years that got you to that point in retrospect?
I mean, I think a lot of it was structural, like just being early into the market for into direct to consumer was super helpful. And I think that initial like realization that like, oh, like a website as a blog, I don't think it's relevant now. Like we're in the process of really reformulating that. But it's time when people used to type in URLs to find new content or follow an RSS feed. Now it's all in social, right? It was like, oh, if we put up something new every week or every couple weeks or something, people come back to our site. It's not just they'll come, but they'll come back. They'll be like, what's new? What's fresh, right? And then email was huge, right? Email is the core of direct consumer in a lot of ways. We ignored a lot of the metrics in email, and we really focused on the open rate and the click rate. when we looked at the metrics at all, and we really just focused on like building like a really, really strong email product that people wanted to open, right? Mm-hmm. Making sure there's actually fresh content, real things in the email, right? Because a lot of people get into the email and it works, especially back then. It was like, it's so powerful. Like, we got scared at one point. Email was such a revenue driver, like in terms of the spikes, that we're like, we need to find other methods of distribution.
Right, without just sending more emails.
Yeah, exactly.
Because then it would stop.
And it takes more and more to get people to open. And you're, so for the longest time, like, our click rates used to be higher than like the industry average open rates, right? And our open rates would be through the roof. And they still are, compared to like what everybody else is getting, because we invest in it and we try and like make sure that like when you get an email from us, there's something new in there. There's something to learn. There's something that we're telling you that's worth opening, not just like, oh yeah, we took another 5% off the thing that we told you about last week. And you know, it's dicey because the email is a super useful tool. So it takes a lot of discipline.
Right. To not over invest and over communicate. Yeah. And
then also like email was crazy. Like when Gmail split the tabs, right?
And started promotions and updates. And
you know, that was just like 5 or 10% off everybody's open rate. It's like, boom, all of a sudden, like, you're not just in the regular inbox. You're in this, like, secondary, like, ghetto inbox, right? So, but email was huge. The blog side, and a big thing there is that that infrastructure was very nascent, right? So you have something like a Hypebeast, right? I don't know what their goals were exactly, but, you know, say it was like 20 posts a day or 25 posts a day, right, or something, but it's way more now. Whatever it was, like, they might only be getting 10, 15 pitches a day or something.
Right. And then so they were need
like,
you.
Yeah, they were out, like, looking for content. And now it's just completely opposite. They might have, like, way more inventory. They might be putting up 100 posts a day or whatever it is, right?
But maybe off of 1,000 pitches or something.
Yeah, exactly. They're just flooded. So that was, like, structural and, like, just being early helped, right? We were, like, in there in the system and, like, we could just present content, take good photographs, and people would run us. But one of the really interesting things that we did that paid off really well and we got kind of lucky was build out our Reddit. You know, we're just getting a lot of traffic from Reddit. Hmm. And we're like, what is this?
Did you know of it or use it before or no?
I had heard of it, but I wasn't a user at all. Yeah. And so we had this one really early instance and it actually turned out to be like a friend of a friend, like just fucking around. Like they were like in the space doing marketing and they were like, yeah, I think I can get these people on the front of Reddit. They got us on the front of Reddit and we were like, what the hell is it? But it was garbage traffic. You know, like the front of Reddit, they're like looking for a joke.
Right.
You know, people would come for 7 seconds and be gone. The bounce rate was through the roof. And so we were like, that's wild. It was like opened our eyes, but it didn't make us like want to dive into Reddit. We're just like, that's a lot of traffic, but it's not the traffic we need. But then like this particular subreddit called Male Fashion Advice, we started getting all this traffic and we'd be like, where is this traffic coming from? And we'd go follow the link. And we'd be like, this is a random post about t-shirts or, you know, shorts or something. Like, where's the link to us? And you dig like 200 comments down and there'd be a link and it'd be driving like real traffic. And we'd be like, wow, this is powerful.
Right. Because it's like a fraction of a fraction of a fraction.
Yeah, exactly. And so we were like, this is powerful. Like, what do we do with it? And it took us a while playing around. So one of the things we noticed, and it's also the same in other internet forums. You know, Reddit's kind of started dominating like in the forum space, but there are other forums too of discussion that like if you would show up, the tone of the conversation would change completely, right?
You being the brand.
Yeah, as a person associated with the brand, right? Like not just like here's a brand account, anonymous, right?
Because that people hate and will expel it.
Yeah. No, just as a human being and being like, boom, here I am. Like, let me address like your concerns. Let me talk to you, like listen, talk. And the conversation, the tone would just shift. It's the same thing as like if somebody's talking behind your back versus like you in the room. It's really the same thing. And the internet's got this notoriety for getting really, really toxic. And it certainly happens, right? There's like toxic spirals that happen in like internet conversations in different comment sections or whatever. But I think it's a little exaggerated, right? There's still healthy dialogue happening all over the internet. And so when you get out there and put yourself out there and put the energy in, like you have a certain control over that dialogue and you have a voice in there and people aren't going to just like spew garbage like and make stuff up, which people are prone to do. And sometimes they just have genuine misunderstandings or whatever it is that like makes things spiral in weird ways. But we just get out there and try and be really honest and upfront. And when you're wrong, admit that you're wrong. And when you think somebody else is wrong, like not just yell at them and tell them they're wrong, but like try and get them to a point where they understand that maybe they made a mistake or an error, or like it's actually just their opinion, not an absolute fact, right? So there's a lot of stuff like we learned just kind of diving into these spaces and playing around and working with the conversation. And then we were like, what happens if we have our own subreddit? And I think it's literally still called like an experimental space for Outlier or something. But we were just like, all right, let's make r/Outlier, like the Outlier subreddit. And people started coming and talking, and it became like this really powerful tool. And like, there's a community there, and there's people that care about our products, and sometimes they get mad that we're going in a direction they don't want us to or whatever, but, and they have their opinions, and it's, they're all like humans, and it's great, and it's actually quite civil, and it's become like this really useful tool. And so at one point we realized that we were too heavily dependent on email as a direct-to-consumer brand. And one of the things we realized is that we could use Reddit as a tool. We almost had to, because Reddit has this interesting thing among the social media spaces in that like you don't have that much control over the dialogue, right? Like if we're on Instagram and we launch a product at 1 o'clock and we don't put an Instagram post up till 3, that doesn't really matter, right? Because somebody might post about it or whatever, but like it's our Instagram feed, and like people, they just don't know the product's out, but like it doesn't change the discussion. But on our Reddit, if we don't post it within a minute of putting it up, like somebody else is going to post it, and then we lose control of discussion to a certain extent. And we still want like an active discussion going on, but we were like, oh, we're going to post something on our website, we might as well post it on the Reddit at the same time. And then we make the post, we can pin the post or whatever. And like, we essentially started launching products on Reddit. You know, they're technically launched on the website, but like a lot of times, especially for the smaller stuff, it just goes up to the Reddit. It gives us a range of scale, really interesting range of scale for a brand, because the Reddit is a small subset of our consumers, but they're very active and they're very passionate. And it's not just on Reddit, you know, it goes out onto social media channels and things as well. But the Reddit's like sort of the point of discussion, right, where there's the most energy. So if we launch something on Reddit, we can launch stuff really small and do experiments and like test and play around in public, but not in like the mass public. It lets us like prototype, like, you know, Instagram will prototype changes and they'll like release it to like, you know, for them, like 100,000 is a tiny fraction of their users.
0.01%, whatever. Yeah. Whatever,
but they'll be like, yeah, we just tested it with 100,000 users, see like what happened with this interaction change. And if it does well, then we'll roll it out to everybody, right? So it's the same sort of thing, like where we can test in public to a small set of people without like advertising, without blasting it out.
Is there stuff that goes on Reddit that is never in the emails?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. There's stuff that goes out onto Reddit that's gone within minutes. And then, you know, when it's successful, we obviously want to bring it back. But that means a lot of different things when you're talking about physical product, right? And so everything has to line up. So sometimes we can't bring it back. Physical stuff takes way longer than people realize. That's one of the really interesting challenges, is like a very product-driven brand. You know, we're working on like 6, 9, 12-month cycles for a lot of stuff. And the internet moves in like 2-hour cycles or something, right? So like that discord between the speed that different things operates is really a challenge.
So some other brands, and I'm thinking of like Glossy specifically, have talked a lot about the over-reliance on social media, and that they've said they're building this platform that will live on their site to have the beauty conversation take place under their purview, so to speak. It sounds like you've found Reddit serves that role for you effectively. Do you have thoughts, or do you care that it's not on your website, it's not a form on your website, you don't, you know, own it, so to speak? Or would it not work like it does if it was under your umbrella?
I wouldn't say it wouldn't work, but I think people don't always realize that we control it, which I guess is kind of devious in a way. I mean, it's, we're not denying it or anything, but like people think it's just a random Reddit that somebody started, and like we actually have the ability to delete comments and things like that, right? So it's a nice balance, right? It's like open and public, and we try and be really respectful. You know, obviously you get like weird racists popping up and stuff like that, that we're just like out, that doesn't play. But we try and be really respectful of people criticizing our products, right? They have a voice, and like, and we're there so we can dialogue with them. But like, we try and like keep it like open and as free as possible. You know, there's this bag company called Tom Bin that runs a bag forum for their customers on their site, and it's quite active. So it's possible to do it. That's the only example I can think of, though. It's nice to put yourself out in public and give people a space they feel comfortable and like tools that they're comfortable with. But it's a balance, and you know, and who knows what happens with Reddit. Like one day it could just vaporize, or I get why brands are like don't want to rely on this stuff. It's
algorithm changes, et cetera.
Oh, I mean, yeah. Instagram, especially since the management has changed there, right? And so the original founders are gone, like And who knows, but you know, my gut is that they were like part of like what kept Instagram like really good, you know, like having that overarching human vision to like counteract some of like the mass corporate decisions that often get made, or really with these companies, algorithmic decisions, right? Where they're humans saying like, oh, this number looks better than that number, so we're going to go this way, without really like necessarily following through on like what it really means in the long term for the product. So I'm a little worried about what's going to happen on Instagram.
2015-ish is when this starts to happen. You look at what's happening with website traffic and so forth. What do you start to do? Because it sounds like Reddit was going in the background and it was growing. So there was probably some diversification there.
Yeah.
But what did the last, I guess, 3 years look like?
You know, we were focused on product and we're focused on our core, and we had a banner year. It was great. Growth was great. And then in 2016, like, it was a crazy year with the election and everything. And so like there was a lot of distraction and things weren't as good. And we started thinking about other stuff. And it wasn't really until 2017 that we were like, oh, wow, like we got to like learn how to market. Like we got to figure this stuff out. We're not seeing the growth. We were basically flatlining. We weren't shrinking. We were flatlining, not like flatlining dead, like a heart attack, like just plateauing. Yes. Right. So we're like, what's going on? And then we're like, all right, well, our web traffic hasn't been growing. And like we identified that at one point and decided to ignore it. And then we're like, all right, let's get in it. And so like, let's start using all the tools that everybody else is using. So the low hanging fruit with marketing right now, and I don't know how much it still applies in 2019, but I think it still is Facebook. I'm pretty sure it's Facebook just because their algorithm for finding like lookalike users is so much better than anybody else's out there, especially on Facebook itself. It's not actually as good on Instagram. Mm. That's just kind of like a magic tool for anybody, because it finds these customers that are basically the same as your existing customers. I mean, you can put in different inputs, but you can put in your customer list or your mailing list or whatever, right? And then it finds these people that essentially are your customers, but they don't know about you, which is just like magic, right?
Yeah.
So that was great. We're like, okay, wow. And I'm not a big Facebook user. That's why we had sort of ignored it for so long, and we're not using that product now. It has diminishing returns, essentially. But that's how like a lot of the early direct-to-consumer brands grew up to a certain point, and then it caps out. Then it becomes like kind of difficult, and like you got to pay a lot of money to reach like who you want and stuff. But
does that mean to you that you've hit the cap of who your customers can be, or only within the microcosm of Facebook have they provided diminishing returns? And you're like, okay, this tool itself is exhausted.
We stopped using it partly because like we weren't getting exactly the same numbers, but also partly because we're not big fans of Facebook and like we were working on building other structures, right? But you know, ultimately it was like Facebook felt off brand for us, because like neither me nor my partner or very many people in our company were like huge Facebook users, and it's a maturing product, right? So the average age is growing, and it's different spaces.
So it was like a year that you spent
pretty
using
much
it a little bit. Yeah.
No, we use it pretty extensively, and it's great. You know, like they have an amazing tool. They built the best ad product for a certain scale. And then it was like, all right, let's play around with the other tools. So PR, Instagram, Twitter, just dive out there and see what works and keep playing around. And I don't know if we have the answers at all, but you know, we've been playing around in the space a lot, and so it's been fun, and like we're seeing a lot. This is a rapidly changing marketing environment. What works today like might not work at all tomorrow, right? So the first thing you have to be is quick on your feet. Be aware, you know. I'm trying to figure out TikTok right now, what we can do there. And I don't have the answers at all.
What's intriguing to you about it?
It feels really like pure in this funny way, right? For, I mean, it's a huge, gigantic corporate beast out of Shanghai, right? But it's like got that like new hit energy, right? It's different, it's fresh, and like the content that people put up there is like exciting, and like there's kind of this innocence still to it, right? It's just more fun.
It's kind of like an inverted Vine in a way.
Yeah, it definitely like has the level of Vine, but it has this amazing internationalness, which is incredible. It has like almost a better implementation of the algorithm. Like a lot of these other products, like the algorithm came in after the timeline. They were like, build a timeline, and they put the algorithm to like reorganize the timeline, but it's still a timeline. And it's really frustrating to people who grew up with the timeline still. You're like, it's an imperfect match. Whereas like in TikTok, you're in the algorithm. And there is sort of a timeline of your followers that you can get to. But the interface like de-emphasizes the fact that it's a timeline, right? It's like the full screen and you're in it. And the default mode is just to be in the algorithm. And the algorithm is seemingly pretty damn good. Like it gives you content that you're like, wow, this is enjoyable, right? So I think it's like the next level. Like that's where you have to be. It's sort of like embrace the algorithm to a certain extent it makes it more enjoyable. But from a marketing standpoint, I don't really know. Yeah. We haven't figured out like what it is. So, I mean, what makes it stand out is that people put more effort into it than they put into Instagram. Instagram is kind of like a documentary app. You know, it's an embellished documentary, like, but it's still like documenting what you do with your day and trying to make it look as cool as possible.
Especially with stories as well.
Yeah. TikTok is like a performance medium, right? People are trying to perform for TikTok. That's a lot harder, right? So from like a viewer standpoint, it's great, right? You're like, wow, people worked really hard to make this content for me. But from a brand standpoint, like, you have to invest a lot more from the get-go to exist on that platform. Or that's my hypothesis. Right now, I'm just kind of in like enjoy it mode and like, you know, mess around mode and see.
Talk a bit about, I guess, how the brand use of Instagram has evolved, maybe specifically around Instagram Live, which has now become this kind of recurring thing.
Yeah, we went through a lot of phases with Instagram. At one point, we were just sort of using it almost like Tumblr. Actually, it came out of Tumblr. We had a Tumblr that we were just kind of curating and like inspiration, and the stuff seems super dated, but like it makes sense. Like at the time, we were just like, yeah, we're going to put up like art. You know, we had somebody like working part time on it, like finding cool, interesting inspiration stuff that like, you know, mood boards and stuff.
Like,
you know,
The Row does that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's going to post any product stuff. It's like only inspiration stuff. Yeah,
that was a thing. So we started with that and then became a lot more product focused. And so we do a lot of product stuff on there. And then Live came about. We release products every weekly. You know, it's a drop model, right? That's obviously growing and growing in the apparel industry. And so we're releasing stuff every week, and we do it every Tuesday at 1 o'clock. So it's a regular schedule. And we're just like, what happens if we like go live while we release this product, just talk about it? And it's been amazing level of dialogue, right, that we can do. And at first we actually did it at 1 and the product came out at 1. And eventually we realized that we should do it before the product comes out, so people can like listen to us talk about it, then decide if they want to buy it or not. It's interesting because the Instagram audience is very different than the Reddit audience. Obviously, some of the Reddit people like go over there deliberately and whatnot, but the organic audience in there is like very, very different. So we're hitting different sets of customers, right, with this kind of communication. But it's really natural and like it's straightforward, and like you can talk to people, and like we talk about our product and then we talk about what's going on, and it's a dialogue, right? And people can, you know, the comments work. And so like you can literally be on there, listen, people ask questions and be like, can you show us this? And we'll be like, yeah, we can show you that, right? And it's really nice and natural. It's my favorite part of Instagram right now. But again, at the same time, like you can't just be live all the time, right? It's limited. Like, so we're trying to like keep it in a healthy place, right? Like not blow it out. But it lets you connect directly to people, which is key, right, in this day and age.
What like hasn't worked in the last few years, or like what have been some of the bigger misses from a marketing perspective, where either you had like high hopes and they just didn't, or it's just kind of like a response?
We're very like hypothesis driven. So we don't, it's rare that we have like really high hopes, I guess. The way I approach things in particular, but you know, it comes through the whole company, is like, let's go out and test it and see, and then like build off of that. But definitely like Instagram from an advertising perspective has been really frustrating. I don't like their ad product. It makes sense for certain brands. I've heard that for like big consumer product groups, like they think it's like the best thing on the internet, closest thing to TV for them. But these are like giant, corporations spending like insane amounts of money. And so it kind of makes sense. I like the ad product itself, like especially the story ones. Like I think they look good. It's like the first ad product that really takes over your whole screen, right? So you're using the real estate, and you know, we're in a phone centric world now, right? And so like, instead of having like a little piece of the phone, you get the whole phone for a second, right? So that part I love. But I find like for like more like tactical driven, like sales driven ads, it's not that great. And that's partly because Instagram is very greedy with like linking out, you know, they make it like hard for people to organically get out of their ecosystem. And so now they're trying to build the sales product in there.
The Instagram checkout and product tags and
Yeah, I'm pretty hesitant to deal with that.
Because?
I don't trust Facebook. I don't need that data in the Facebook ecosystem. And I don't need them taking like a chunk in that way. I feel like Instagram is probably peaking. It's like got that Yogi Berra problem, right? Like nobody goes there anymore. It's too crowded. And it's compounding on itself right now, right? Because like I see like maybe 5% of the stories people post a day or something, right? And like the algorithm is kind of determining like which ones I see by popping it. And it gets some of it right. There's certain people that, yeah, definitely I want that there, and that's what I'm clicking on. But sometimes I'm like, why is this other thing buried there, you know? But from a brand perspective, like, if you want people to, like, watch your stories and it's similar in the feed, not quite to the same extent, like, you have to post a lot. Now you're posting more, there's more content, and so, like...
Right, you're feeding the problem, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There's, like, it's even harder for people to see all of it. So, you know, it's been a long time since you could see all of Instagram, right? But most people were comfortable with it because I think they felt like they were getting, like, what they needed out of it. Now I really feel like I'm missing. I'm like, wow, like, my friend posted that, and, like, I missed that. And so I don't know how sustainable it is and how they break out of that challenge. And they have really talented designers working on the product, so maybe they will figure it out. But we've never, like, found the Instagram model. We played around a lot with it, both in the feed and the stories. And from a tactical-driven ad, like, there are a few products that blew up off of it, but they're very particular. Like, you have to basically optimize your product for what is really accessible on Instagram. It's tricky because it can't be too low because you're dealing with shipping. You're dealing with direct consumer, right? So shipping can't be too big of a percentage of the cost. But at the same time, it can't be too high. You have to be able to make an impulse purchase. It's hard to even get your credit card in there because it's not in the regular web interface, right? You're in their sub interface. And so if you have your saved credit card, like, in your browser, like, you can't actually do it in Instagram, which is crazy, right? So it's really tricky to do that kind of tactical driven stuff. That's not really our main focus anyhow. We like to do sort of like secondary tactical, like, we're trying to, you know, not push a product instantly, like add to sale, but add over time to a sale. And we found it's just not that well optimized to it. For that exact reason, like, versus Facebook, especially when it's on the web, it just links straight to your website, and then you're into another ecosystem and, like, a tighter connection to the actual transaction. And so, again, Instagram has their product they're rolling out right now that they're trying to solve that. But it's, like, kind of the same thing with publishers. You really want to give up, like, a big chunk of your core competency to this third party that's giant and is kind of proven that they're not very trustworthy. The flip side, and I think where Instagram does work well, is branding ads. But the problem is that branding ads require, like, very large investments. So customer acquisition, awareness, brand awareness, like, it works, but you got to, like, go in there with a pretty big buy, right? So you need a lot of budget.
Right, and you're also kind of bidding against all the direct response ads, too, so it's even more expensive.
Oh, I mean, the prices have gone through the roof, and it's sort of the only game in town. Like, obviously, like, you can still do search ads, but that's, like, such a different thing that, like, it doesn't even feel comparable. It's really, like, the only really well fleshed out brand type ad out there. The product itself is good, but it, like, it's a narrow channel that it's going through.
It's even, like, with monopolistically good.
Yeah. Well, even, like, with a billion users, it's still a narrow channel. And so there's, people are sick. There's so many ads on there. The other problem is that you can't control who your, what ad is next to yours, right? That's actually a huge problem on a fashion perspective, right? Like, that's, if you look at, like, how traditional fashion advertising is going, it's all about placement. It's all about, like, yeah, I'm paying more to be in the front of the book, or, like, if I'm, like, an artier brand, I want to be somewhere a little bit back where it's a little bit cheaper, but I want to know exactly where I'm placed because that context is super important.
Right. Places like YouTube and so forth have run into this problem from a political standpoint in a bunch of other ways too.
When you're in Instagram, you have some control over the feeds you're into. Not great, but, like, you can at least have, like, some control over that. But, like, if your ad is next to an ad for, you know, like, wow, dental floss or whatever, like, that's not on brand, and it could be awful. It could be an ad for a knockoff of you, right? And so that's what gets associated in consumers' mind. They're like, oh yeah, I saw this brand ad, it was really cool, and they can associate it with their own feed, which is good, right? But then they're also associating it with, like, ads you have no control over. So that's tricky. But in the end of the day, like, as a bootstrapped company, that, like, we're still pretty small, we've grown quite a bit, but, like, we're still pretty small. It just didn't seem like we had the budget to play that game the right way. It's tempting and it's kind of fun, and it's still actually, like, the product itself, right? And that's kind of, like, they're victim of the fact that they built a really good product and nobody else did.
Has the increased focus on marketing in the last few years changed at all how you're buying inventory or thinking about supply as the demand piece has changed, or has that stayed constant?
No, that's pretty much constant. Our structure is very much like we do, like, very small experiments, and then we try, and it's a hit-based model essentially, right? Like, we're doing lots of small experiments, and then we're trying to build hit products, right? So, and once we have a hit, and it, there's different stages to that, and when we have a hit product, we grow it and try and push it and try and grow it, and then the really small stuff is like kind of sub marketing level. It's for the people that already know about the brand, and where it can have like marketing corollaries sometimes, but for the most part, we're doing that for the community itself, right? For our existing customers. And when it comes to marketing, it's about taking like something that we've proven is a hit that has real value in the market and find new people, mm-hmm. new customers, new people that are actually going to appreciate like what we're producing.
What led you to start launching stuff on Depop?
We invested in a direct to garment printer. It's not even super new, but it's a relatively new piece of technology. And it's really interesting in a fashion context because it's not sold into the general apparel market. They're not trying to sell it to Gap or small brands even. It's sold to a totally different market, which is like the sort of silk screeners and embroiderers and like these sort of mom and pop businesses that like will make the uniforms for the high school football team and stuff. And it's a large infrastructure. Like every town needs somebody mm-hmm. who can make uniforms and can embroider. The local motorcycle gang needs somebody who can embroider their vests, right? And things like, so there's this whole infrastructure there. But it's sort of this parallel, smaller apparel world, right? So silk screening is a huge part of it. And so there's this new technology that's essentially launched into that world that's quite interesting. And so we were like, let's play with it. Let's get it. And the beautiful thing about Depop, the easiest way to explain it actually is, so we have this concrete table that we like to photograph items on for small run things. And it's where we do our Instagram live. So it's like kind of like this sort of defining piece of architecture for the outlier kind of like mobile type experience. And so we have these metal stairs that you can climb up on, and you can like get right on top of the product and just photograph straight down onto the product. And when we put things on Depop, you just go up, you photograph, take four photos of this product, and then I would literally post the entire thing to Depop before I get off the stairs. So basically like standing on a ladder, like taking photos. Their interface is so fast and easy that I could post the product before I got off the ladder. And I don't know any other product like that. And so
an e-com product.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically as easy as doing an Instagram post. If you're trying to sell a lot of stuff, all kinds of weaknesses emerge, right? Like it's a very limited but specific product, but when you're doing one-offs, it's incredible. And so it let us put one-offs up there, and it's fun. And the printing stuff is very new, and we aren't successful with it yet. I still love it. It's super fun, but it's not like a runaway hit. It's very different than like, you know, we sell unbranded items, right? Like our core customer is like looking for unbranded stuff, not printed stuff. So it's a whole new space, but you know, we're built around exploring constantly. So we're playing with it, and Depop was a great tool for it, and we're still using it. We're going to do like another big Depop run in a few weeks, actually. It's expensive, you know, they take 10%. Which is like a nice healthy chunk, and it's super limiting with things like returns and stuff like that. But for small run stuff, it's a great tool, and mm-hmm. I love it.
It's interesting, I guess, talking about Reddit, Instagram Live, Depop, the sense that it sounds like you've made conscious decision to prioritize audience and use case over control. Because like you could do all those things on your own site. You could drive people to a form on your own site, live, etc. But it seems conscious.
It's good to be tied into these social. You have yeah. to in this world, right? Like you do it on your website and you're essentially only marketing to your own customers, right? And we want to be out in public and in the world. You know, I think one of the key things that's like transformative in how direct to consumer has evolved over the last 10 years is that nobody walks past a website, right? But in the early days, people were hungry for stuff. And so like you essentially got effects similar to foot traffic, right? So like, you know, Zara spends almost nothing on traditional marketing right. because they're spending insane amounts of money on prime real estate yep. and also shopping bags, right? And things like that. So that essentially is their marketing, like buying, you know, the old Nat Sherman store on 42nd and Fifth Avenue. That's a marketing expense at the end of the day, right? So, and it also happens to be a place where people buy lots and lots of product and it's very profitable. So they have a good formula, right? But there's no foot traffic on the internet. You can't replicate that formula. So you have to get out into social media and like find some good real estate on social media.
What's it like trying to build and market a brand that, as you said, is unbranded by nature? Like, does that make your job harder, or does it actually help you find the people that are going to talk about it, which becomes the way that new people learn about it?
I mean, yes and no. It's certainly a lot of levels where it makes it harder, right? Like a prominent logo is a piece of advertising and it's essentially subsidizing the cost of clothing. We work a lot in the outdoor market and we also work a lot in the fashion side, right? And we see these two worlds and how different they are. The outdoor world, every single thing has a prominent and not very attractive logo. But the margins are much lower in the outdoor world. And it's one of my prime hypotheses is that essentially that's literally functioning as an ad, right? In the fashion world, there's a level where a logo might function as an ad, but it actually is designed to add value in a way. They're functioning very differently, right? And so when you go buy an outdoor brand, you're essentially saying, I'm going to spend less money for this because I'm putting an advertisement on it. And then other people are going to be like, oh, that brand, right? And so you're functioning in that way. We don't do that, right? So essentially it means we don't get the free advertising. But on the flip side, it's really nice because there's a lot of people that are looking for that, right? So it was kind of a nice market opportunity, but it eliminates certain pieces of low-hanging fruit that other brands have access to that we don't. So it's challenging sometimes.
Yeah. In terms of the evolution from the PR side, so we talked before about kind of just the nascent infrastructure in the blogging world. It sounds like you kind of slowed that down, put that on hold kind of in the middle, and then more recently have turned back to PR. And I think you've seen more articles and features about the brand and so forth. How has the thought process kind of evolved there? And also, how is the role that PR plays for the brand changed, if at all?
We did a bunch of PR and I like it. It feels like a lot of diminishing returns. And I think part of the problem is that people are just moving more and more away from traditional media, right? And even when they do consume traditional media, how they get there is different, right? So it's almost like it doesn't matter. These traditional media brands have audiences. They have real audiences. So that's worth quite a bit, actually. But at the end of the day, what really matters is how viral it can go. And it has very little relevance, where the site is. Having a good media brand gives you a jump start, right? Because there's a subset of audiences. But if it's really exciting and it is going to go viral, as long as you get a dozen people onto the thing, it'll pick up, right? Because they're going to repost it and that's how it works, right? And the viralness itself is what's going, and it doesn't really matter where the outlet is. So we're not doing a lot of PR right now. We did a bunch and it was cool, but there's sort of a diminishing returns on that pretty quickly. You get some stories and you hit the editors that you want and they're like, yeah, we ran that story. So what's next, right? One interesting space that we are really interested in is the video reviewers and and that type of blogger. There's a whole interesting world of people and they have passionate followings. And I mean, I guess it's influencer, but deeper, it's instead of just a surface level influencer, it's I actually review these products and I dig into them. And so that's definitely an interesting space for us. And so we've been trying to work with those type of people and get our product out there. And then we've been doing our own YouTube stuff, which is new and fun. And we'd avoided video for a long time because it's heavy production in some ways, but it's a whole new channel. And I don't know, it's interesting. It feels like it's the end game for Google. You don't use Google to get to websites as much as you used to, but you use it to get to videos, or you go straight to YouTube, which is Google, right? The video world is still very much search and then find, right? Whereas for a website, you're less and less inclined to start at Google to end up on a website. You're going to just go onto your social channels and find websites that way. So it's an interesting change, right?
Yeah. It seems like most of the advertising is focused around the products, the models, so forth. Have you thought about using, given kind of the, call it deep interest from existing customers, more user-generated content, testimonials, et cetera? Or do you want to exert more control over kind of how it's presented?
No, I think that goes back to what we were talking about, us not having a logo, and a lot of our stuff is core kind of items, right? Everyday items. So it's not natural for that type of marketing. Right. Because it's oh, you have a black T-shirt on. You don't know if it's an outlier black T-shirt or another black T-shirt. And there's brands that have copied our pattern or whatever. So they look the same from in a photograph. Right. So it doesn't play super well in there. Right. It's whereas if you're a brand that's all about graphics or about how prominent the logo is, then you can do a lot more of that stuff. Right. But when we get user generated content, it can be good and bad, and we do use some of it, but it's not distinct, right? Mm. We're making clothes that function more in the real world than they do on the social media space.
You posted something on Twitter about customers and price.
Oh, yeah. It's just that the Henry Ford, it's not really a Henry Ford quote, but, you know, it's a fake Henry Ford quote that, like, if I ask my customers what they wanted, they want a faster horse, right? This is just something I've noticed over the years. Like, in the end of the day, like, the one consistent thing is that people have, like, a really inherent sense of what the value of these products are in some strange way. But at the same time, like, what they really want is, like, you know, it might be like, oh, I want this feature or that feature. But what they're essentially asking for is something that would blow the price out. In the end of the day, like, even though they don't realize it, like, when you ask your customers what they want, they really want you to sell you your products at a loss, right? They kind of know what it's worth, but they want a better deal. I know, it's really interesting. Like, I haven't looked at it in a while, but when Ron Johnson took over JCPenney, right? And, you know, it was a disaster, but when he launched the takeover, he, like, went to their shareholders meeting, huge public company, lots of shareholders, and did this really in-depth presentation where he laid out his hypothesis, right? And he failed miserably, but I think there's some really interesting stuff in there. And he had this graph where it was like, yeah, like, we've been discounting like crazy, right? And so, like, you look at a JCPenney customer like X amount of years ago, and we would discount a little bit. And at the end of the day, like, the number was 1.8. That was the markup that they're like JCPenney. So I guess that's what, like, a 40% margin ish, right? Somewhere in that zone, right? That was the end of the day after all the discounts were done. Like, people were buying products from JCPenney at 1.8 times the price that JCPenney was paying for them. And then they started ramping up the discounting, which meant they were just raising the base price and then adding discounts and playing this huge discounting game. And at the end of the day, like, people were buying the stuff at 1.8. Like, they'd wait until it was 40% off. Like, they wouldn't buy anything until it was 40% off. But at the end of the day, they were paying 1.8 times what JCPenney was doing. And actually, like, there's a kind of interesting hypothesis I came to recently. I think where he really went wrong is that he didn't realize that all the discounting games that JCPenney were doing, you know, he thought that was like free money. They could stop discounting and people would pay 1.8 and like they were good. But he didn't realize that like all the work they were doing into discounting was actually giving customers value because they enjoyed it, right? Like they liked getting like the hunt, the deal. Yeah. And so like all that money that they were spent on marketing and thinking up promotions and stuff is actually adding to the value. People weren't paying 1.8, they were paying like 1.8, but then they were discounting all the free like game like enjoyment that JCPenney was adding in,
and that's what people wanted.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. And so like he looked at it and it was like, oh yeah, we take away the discount game and people still pay 1.8, but no, they want to pay 1.6 because that's what the value is without the gaming, right?
Right. And no one's doing this math as a customer anyway.
Yeah. But what was really interesting in all that is like customers do have this like innate sense of like what something is actually worth and what the value is, which is fascinating, right? As a business person, right? You're like, wow, like how do they figure it out? But it's like this read of the market and it's imperfect and like people gamify it in all kinds of different ways. But like at the end of the day, like people have a pretty good sense, right? And so when you're talking to your customers and they're like, yo, I want this and I want this, like what's frustrating is like, you know how much it costs and like what they're asking for. And sometimes you think it's a good idea. Sometimes you think it's a bad idea, but often like they're basically asking for you to make your product unprofitable because that's what they really want. Like, you know, everybody wants like the best, but like they don't want to necessarily spend insane amounts of money for it, right? So they're like, I want it at this price and I want all these features or all this quality or whatever it is, right? And so, you know, we just try and focus on delivering the best value that we can in the end of the day.
Yeah. What's the cheapest and most expensive lesson you've learned in the last kind of 3 years from a marketing perspective?
Instagram was an expensive lesson, that's for sure. Instagram advertising, you know, like we've gone in and out of that quite a few times and it's been expensive. And it's not like we didn't get anything out of it, but we had a hard time getting to a point where we were happy with it. But then on the flip, I think Instagram Live was super cheap. Like we turned it on and it worked. And we're like, that's the beauty of them is that they keep making products and they see what works and what doesn't. And so there's things they roll out that I'm like, no way. Like I'm not doing that. I don't need that. I don't want that. But then they stumble on things that like work really, really well. And they iterate and they execute well when they have that. So that's been great.
Do you think the product matters less today than it did back then in terms of driving the business forward?
No, not at all. I'm still a product person at the end of the day. There's people that aren't product people and they can buy commodities and there's an incredible world of commodities out there. But like if anything, it matters more because we're in this very information rich world, right? I think that's one of the fundamental things, right? Like, if you think about 15, 20 years ago, if you went into a store, you have very little information. You had the price, you had like what was on the tag, and you had like whatever kind of knowledge you carried in there about like cotton versus polyester or whatever. And then you had the brand, right? You had like some kind of inbuilt knowledge associated with the brand. And then, you know, if there was a good salesperson or you cut out something from a magazine, you might have a little more information. But for the most part, you were like making decisions in a very like low information environment. And ultimately, it was about price, the product, and the brand. But you didn't know what went behind the product. You can only see the surface, you know, touch it and whatever. Now you can go and read for days or watch videos for days, mm-hmm. like digging into every little piece of like, where does the cotton come from? Like, why is this better than this? Like, somebody, I tested 100 t-shirts, right?
You want to be the last one standing in that world.
Yeah, like your product has to stand. There's a lot. And there's a commodity space out there and it exists. And like, that's a super valid place, but you're competing with Amazon and you got to like, you know, have your edge in that world, which means like having incredible logistics and infrastructure and everything. And then there's like the sort of elevated product where you're like trying to make really, really good product and people want it and they'll look for it. And so I think it's still super, super important.
Awesome, man. Thanks so much for talking.
Awesome. Yeah. Pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Megaphone Podcast, a show from Loose Threads. You can read full transcripts of the podcast and join the newsletter at loosethreads.com. Feel free to leave a review on iTunes. We always appreciate it. And thanks to George Drake Jr. for editing this episode. We have a great roster of upcoming guests, and we hope you tune in next week.